They both are true. But anyway, parables of Jesus. And so we want to look at Luke 18, at this parable found in verses 1 through 8. Then he spoke a parable to them that men ought always to pray and not lose heart, saying there was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God nor regard man. And there was a widow in that city, and she came saying, "Give justice to me from my adversary." And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, "Though I do not fear God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me." Then the Lord said, "Hear what the unjust judge said. And shall not God avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? I tell you, he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth?" This parable is called the parable of the persistent widow. Sometimes the importunate widow. Sometimes it's the parable of the unjust judge. I like the persistent widow. However you describe this parable, it is a parable about prayer. So verse 1 so describes that he spoke a parable to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to lose heart, or the King James says, faint. It is a parable about prayer. It's about a particular point about prayer. And that is what we want to pursue in our study tonight. Let's start with the context. Context is always important because quite often there is something in the context that prompts a parable. Not every one of them is that the case, but this one there certainly is. There's something in the context. So let's back up to the previous chapter. Because the previous chapter has everything to do with why Jesus raises what he raises in verses 1 to 8 in this context. So let's go back to Luke, the 17th chapter, beginning at verse 22. Luke chapter 17, verses 22 through 37, seems somewhat parallel to what we find in Mark 13 and Matthew chapter 24. There seems to be a discussion of the second coming of the Lord and perhaps some things also about the destruction of Jerusalem. And I list both here in the title here, that he's dealing with the second coming and the judgment upon Jerusalem. Let's just list what we learn without reading all of those verses. Let's see what is said in that context. Beginning at verse 22 through verse 24, the point seems to be that his coming is going to be seen by all. That the days come when you will desire to see the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it. And they will say, "Look here, look there. Do not follow after them. For as the lightning flashes from the one part of the heaven and shines to the other under heaven, so also will the day of the Son of Man be in his day." In other words, the coming of the Son of Man is going to be seen by all. And so when somebody says, "Well, the Lord came back and the Lord returned, but he came over here somewhere, well, I didn't see it," well, then just don't believe them, because when he returns, it's going to be seen by all, is the point. Now, beginning at verse 25 through verse 30, the question is raised, when will he come? When will this take place? When is his coming? Well, verse 25 says it's going to be after he suffers. From the vantage point of Jesus speaking, he hasn't yet suffered, he hasn't yet died and been buried and raised from the dead. It's going to be after that, so that has to come first. Secondly, beginning at verse 26, it's going to be unexpected. Same terminology that's used in Matthew 24, talking about the second coming of the Lord. It will be as it was in the days of Noah. As it was in the days of Noah, there'll be marrying and giving in marriage, and did not know until the flood came, and the flood came upon them and destroyed them all, verse 27. In other words, they went about their daily activities, and it came suddenly and unexpectedly. Even though they knew it was coming, it came suddenly and unexpectedly. A second illustration of the point is found in verse 28, as it was in the days of Lot. They ate and they drank and they bought and they sold and they planted and they built, and then suddenly God rained fire and brimstone upon Sodom and Gomorrah. So it's going to be unexpected and unannounced. Now verses 31 to 33 are difficult because I define that section as fleeing, though the term flee is never used there, and some question whether it's even talking about that. And the point is that same terminology is used in Matthew chapter 24 with reference to the destruction from Jerusalem, and they ought to flee from that. And it may be, there's a question, is it talking about the destruction of Jerusalem? As per Matthew 24, same terminology. Let's get the words and then we'll talk about the alternative to that. "Said on that day, He was on the housetop, and his goods are in the house. Let him not go down and take them away. Likewise, one who is in the field, let him not turn back. Remember Lot's wife? The point in Matthew 24 in the destruction of Jerusalem is to flee from Jerusalem, flee from the destruction of Jerusalem, and don't go back into the house to take anything out. But the word flee is not used here at all. And it may have reference to the destruction of Jerusalem and the fleeing, or it may have reference, as some have suggested, that he's here talking about the attachment to this life and to flee from the attachments of this life. And don't focus on the here and now, but focus on the second coming of the Lord. Don't be tied down too much in this life. I'll leave that to the commentators and for another study of Luke chapter 17. But I'll notice in verses 34 to 37, let me back up though back to this section. It's really immaterial to the point that's going to be made in Luke chapter 18. That's why I'm not spending a great deal of time on that, because that's immaterial to the point that's going to be made in Luke chapter 18. The point's going to be the same. In 34 to 37, though, his point is the separation of the righteous and the wicked. That would take place into the destruction of Jerusalem, certainly, but it also, and particularly, takes place with reference to the second coming of the Lord. When the Lord comes, there's going to be the separation of the righteous and of the wicked. Now, here's the question. When we come to Luke chapter 18, how does that second coming relate to the subject of prayer? Well, if the second coming is delayed for a while, he's already said it's going to be after his suffering, and then it's going to come unexpectedly. If it's delayed for a while, it may seem like God has forgotten his promise. That was the point in 2 Peter 3, that the scoffers say, where is the promise of his coming? He said he's going to come, but he's not coming back and he's not doing what he said. And it may seem like, since it's delayed for a while, maybe for hundreds of years, thousands of years, God has forgotten his promise. And so then there is a danger of losing heart and therefore not continuing to pray. Go back to verse 1. He spoke a parable to them that men ought always to pray and not lose heart. It would be easy in the midst of all of that when I begin to think, you know what, God said he was coming back. Jesus promised that he would return, but he's not doing that and he hasn't done that. And so we become discouraged and we lose heart and we quit praying. And that is the point of the parable. So what do we do in the meantime while we're waiting on the second coming? Well, we're waiting on the second coming now. So what are we supposed to be doing in the meantime? The Wycliffe Bible Commentary suggested much of the preceding discourse is parallel to Matthew 24. I've already told you that. But this parable is unique to Luke. It shows that he's making an immediate application of Jesus' prophecy. Readiness for his return will be conditioned by prayer. If you want to be ready for the second coming of the Lord, one of the things you must do is that you become ready through prayer. You ought to always be praying and not become discouraged, as per verse 1. Prayer shows that we're maintaining our faith. Look at verse 8. When the Son of Man comes, he's just talked about that in chapter 17. So when he returns on earth, will he really find faith on earth? Interesting that he uses the word really. Will he find faith on earth? More than that, will he really find faith on earth? Will he find people who are still praying to God in spite of the delay of the fulfillment of the promise of his coming? Do you ever begin to think, you know what, it's been 2,000 years since Jesus was here, and I bet it'll be another 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 10,000. I don't know, it's going to be a long, long time before he ever returns. What's my evidence? Well, because he hadn't come yet. And you begin to think that it's always going to be further and further and further down the line. And so whether I pray or not is not really important. That seems to be the thing Jesus is addressing. Now, I know the context in which that sits. He'd been talking about the second coming. And when he comes back, will he find people who still have faith? Let's get to the point of the parable. What is the point? Well, here is the point at verse 1. He tells us, here's what my parable is about. He spoke a parable to this end, that men ought always to pray and not lose heart. Like what Matthew Henry said, he said the parable, this parable has its key hanging at the door and its drift and its design are prefixed. Its key is hanging at the door. Before I even enter this parable, the key's hanging there that unlocks it, that men ought always to pray and not lose heart. That's what the parable is about. And its design is prefixed, he said. And I say amen to that. Now here's the point of verse 1. Men ought always be praying and not lose heart. What's the difference? The point Jesus is making is that you are either always praying or you are losing heart, one or the other. If you are always praying, that means you're not losing heart. You're not discouraged. You're not giving up. If you're losing heart, you're not praying, as per this context. So here is one who, for example, they've been a faithful Christian for a while and they become discouraged. I don't know if Jesus is coming back. I know he said he was, but I'm not sure that he's really coming back. I know he said he is, but I just don't see it. And I'm not praying like I used to. I'm losing my faith. They're losing heart. They're becoming less and less prayerful in their life. If you're always praying, that's a continual praying. Where if I lose heart, I'm growing weary. If I'm always praying, I'm praying at all times. Look at verse 7. Verse 7 of the parable, he said, when his children cry out unto him day and night. That's continually. They cry out unto him at the day. They cry out to him at night. Whereas if I'm losing heart, I give up, as per the rendering of the New International. The men ought always to pray and not give up on prayer. They're giving up on it. Just give up. It doesn't do any good. If I'm always praying, I'm not negligent of my prayer. Whereas if I lose heart, I become discouraged and I become neglectful. Those are the contrast. But furthermore, concerning the point. The point of the parable is that we become not discouraged waiting for an answer to our prayer. Not just waiting on the second coming, but perhaps waiting on an answer to our prayer. And that seems to be the point as I get to verses 2 through 6. We'll come to that in a moment. Listen to William Taylor. I think he captured the thought of the parable. He said, but this describes the case of one who has been long making request for that which has not yet been granted. And it encourages him to continue in his presentation of his petition in spite of its apparent uselessness. As Edersheim, that's Alfred Edersheim, has said, the word always must not be understood as if it meant continuously, but in the sense of under all circumstances. However apparent adverse, where it seems as if the answer could not come, and we therefore in danger of fainting and becoming weary. Do you see the point? Taylor got it right. What Taylor is saying concerning this parable is that this parable is describing one who's making a request to God, and he prays to God, and he prays to God, and he prays to God, and God seemingly hasn't answered his prayer. He's made a request for something, and God hasn't granted that request. And he keeps making that request, and he becomes discouraged, thinking, I don't think God's listening to me. And this parable is spoken to the end that men ought always to pray under adverse circumstances, even when it seems useless to pray, even when it seems like God's not answering your prayer. When God is delaying his answer, you ought to keep on praying. That is the point of the parable. The parable is suggesting there is a need for prayer for in the life of every one of us. And the point is that we, like the widow, have needs that we cannot supply for ourselves. She goes to this unjust judge because there is something she needs she cannot fulfill for herself. She needs his help. And we have needs that we cannot take care of ourselves, and we must go and ask for help. And so every one of us need prayer. Let's look at the parable itself now, beginning at verse 2. So we have the point of the parable, verse 1. Verses 2 through 6 is the parable. That's not many verses. 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And then 7 and 8 is the application Jesus makes of that. So let's look at the parable. Let's analyze the parable by looking at the characters. There are three main characters in the parable. First of all, there's the character of the unjust judge in verse 2. There was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God nor regard man. What do we know about this judge? Well, he doesn't fear God. He's not a good man at all. He doesn't fear God, and he has no respect for man. Those go hand in hand, by the way, Genesis 20. If you don't fear God, you don't respect man. Leviticus 19 makes the same point, by the way. But he doesn't have respect for God. He doesn't stand in fear and awe of God. He's not afraid of displeasing God, but he doesn't care about man either. He really only cares about himself. He's an unjust judge, which means he's not interested in justice. He's not interested in what's fair and what's right for this woman, or anybody for that matter. He's an unjust judge, remember. He would be notorious for taking bribes. And you say, how do you know that? Because he's an unjust judge. And he would be one who would take bribes and would be notorious for that, because remember, he doesn't fear God nor respect man. Then there is the widow, verse 3. What do we know about her? Well, she's defenseless. She's helpless. She has an adversary that's continually oppressing her and troubling her. Some enemy that's doing her wrong that she needs somebody to settle that and take care of her problem. She cannot do that herself, or she would have taken care of that already. R.C. Trench observed that many writers have noticed the exceeding desolation of the state of widowhood in the East and the constant exposure to all manner of oppression. Now, that can happen in any generation, in any society, particularly in the East in biblical times. The widow would be oppressed and feel helpless and have nowhere to go and nowhere to turn. And perhaps that's why 1 Timothy 5 talks about him being taken into the number. She has nothing to offer this man. She cannot offer him a bribe. So she's helpless in the sense that she can't take care of her problem, but she can't go with money and bribe him. I want you to take care of my adversary, and here's some money. Whether it's fair, equitable, or not, I want you to take care of him. Rid me of my adversary. She cannot do that. But she only has one tool. She has one tool that she can use, and that is persistence. So she goes to him and she makes request and she makes request and she makes request and she makes request and she makes request. And if you're beginning to tire of me saying that, think if you were the unjust judge. That's exactly what he did. He got tired of hearing that. And she makes request and she makes request. Now there's a third character here, and that's the adversary. We don't know much about him except he's oppressing this widow. And that's all we need to know about him as per the story. Now let's talk about what the storyline is in the parable. And let's notice the widow's petition, first of all. She goes to the unjust judge and she says to him, "Avenge me of my adversary," she said. Avenge me of my adversary. He is one who has power, he has authority, he can do something about the problem. He may be unjust, he may not fear God, he may not fear man, but he has the power to do something, and so she makes the request. Secondly, I want you to notice in verse 5, her request was continual and it was persistent, according to verse 5. "Yet because this widow troubles me, and I venture, lest by her continual coming," she came to him, and then she came to him, and then she came to him, and then she came to him. And you had to know that sometime, at some point, the unjust judge said, "Oh no, here she comes again. Here she's coming again. And here she's coming again. I'm tired of this." In fact, he said he was tired of it. And I want you to notice concerning this widow that she continued even though for a while the judge did nothing. Look at verse 4. "And he would not for a while..." That is, he wouldn't avenge her for a while, but afterward he said within himself, "Though I do not fear God nor man, I will do something, lest she trouble me more." And I'm paraphrasing that, of course. But that's part of the point of the parable. That she continued with her petition, even though for a while he's doing nothing. She goes to him, and he just basically dismisses her. So she goes back, and he dismisses her. And she goes back, and he dismisses her. And the same thing over and over and over. But she persisted. That's the point of the parable. Now let's talk about the judge's response to that. The judge's response was, at first he did nothing to help her at all. Look at verse 4. Verse 4 said he delayed what help he did give. Now, did he finally avenge her? Yes, he did. But it was delayed because verse 4 said he would not for a while, but afterward he said, "Though I do not fear God, I'll take care of that." Now, verses 4 and 5, I want you to notice his concern was only with his own convenience. Let's look at verse 4 and 5 and read those again. In verse 4, he said, he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, "Though I do not fear God nor regard man, yet because of this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me." What's he saying? He's saying, I'm really only concerned with my own convenience. I really don't care about her, or I would have taken care of her at first. I really don't care about her feelings, because I would have taken care of that at first. But the reason I'm doing this is for my own convenience. I'm tired of her wearying me. I want to get rid of her. That's what he's saying. Her persistence would weary him, according to verse 4. But I want you to notice the American Standard rendering of that, that she would wear me out. It literally means lest she assault me. A.D. Robertson observes that literally it means to beat under the eye, the very concept from which we get the idea of a black eye. And so there is a question among students, textual critics, as to what is this phrase actually saying? And then also among commentators, what is this actually saying? Is it that he really feared that she kept coming back and is she getting more agitated and she's going to beat on me and she'll give me a black eye? She'll beat me under the eye, literally. Vinson and Taylor say the same thing. Or the English Standard, I think, renders that something about lest she beat me down. That may be the idea. Not that she would literally beat me, but she's going to wear me down. Whatever the case, he's only concerned about himself. And I'll finally avenge her. Why? Because I don't want her to beat me down. She's wearing me out. Now I know what the parable is. I'm more interested in the application at verses 7 and 8. And let's get the point of the parable. Here's Jesus' comment about that. He said, here's the purpose for the parable, verse 1. Here's the parable 2 through 6. Now listen to my application of that 7 and 8. What is my application? Well, here's what his application is. And shall God not avenge his own elect who cry out night and day to him, though he bears long with them? That's a key point, though he bears long with them. I tell you, he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? Now let's see what he's actually saying in verses 7 and 8. He's saying at verse 7, the Lord will avenge his own who cry. When my people cry out to me, I will avenge them of their adversaries. I will answer their cry. This is an important point. This is the key to understanding the parable. And that is, this passage is a contrast, not a comparison. God is not being compared to the unjust judge. God is being contrasted to the unjust judge. Taylor said the argument is not so much from the less to the greater, but from the worse to the better. It is not saying God is like an unjust judge. God is different than the unjust judge. That's the point of the parable. It is a contrast. What are you saying in this parable is if this woman obtained her request, then so can we. If she went to one who was so unjust and didn't fear God and didn't think about man, and she finally got her request by her persistence, then how much more can we when we approach the great and high and the holy God? Now, what she intended to do was wear the judge down. According to the parable, she goes in and she asks, and she goes back and she asks, and she goes back and she asks. You've seen that with your own children sometimes. They ask and they ask and they ask and they ask, and you really didn't want to let them, but finally you just got tired. Yeah, you can do it. Get out of here. Go. Just go. I'm tired of talking about that. And perhaps the child knew they could wear you down. Well, she knew she could wear the judge down. But he was unjust and uncaring. And the point of the parable is, if she could go to this unjust and uncaring judge and get her request granted, how much more can we when we go to our great God? And so don't become discouraged when you've asked God for something and it doesn't seem like he's answering. And you ask him again, didn't seem like he answered that time. And you ask him again and it still seems like he's delaying his answer. You remember about a woman going to an unjust judge and she finally got her way. But you're not going to an unjust judge, you're going to the great God. And what I learned from this parable is that God is merciful and caring and he wants to avenge his people. Even though, go to verse 7, even though it looks like that for the time he is not interposing. Go back to verse 7. Shall not God avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? What does it mean he bears long with them? He's delaying his answer. So you ask God for something and God didn't grant that right away. And you say, well, what's happening here? I think I'll ask God again. And so you pray again and it seems like, well, God didn't hear that, I reckon, because he didn't give me what I asked for. And so you ask again. He's bearing along with you. That's what he's doing. He's delaying his answer. So ask again. And so ask again. And so ask again is the point of the parable. Now, here's the point Jesus is making. First, the Lord will avenge his own people. But now at verse 8, will the Lord find faith on earth? Are you finally going to give up on your faith and say, you know what, I prayed to God and he didn't answer, and so I just give up on God? Or will the Lord find faith on earth? Back to verse 1. Will he find people who have faith to continue to pray and not give up? When you pray and God didn't answer it the way you wanted, do you just give up on God? Or do you keep praying? That's what he's talking about at verse 8. Go back to verse 8 again. When the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on earth? Will the Lord bear with them long? When the Lord comes, will he find faith that in the people that God will do what he says? When God says that he's going to return, will he find people who have faith that God does what he says? Will he find people who have faith that God will answer though it takes some time? People who still say, you know, I believe God's going to answer my prayer. I believe he will, and maybe his answer is no, but I'm praying, and I've been praying, and I've been praying for a long time, and I've prayed many times for this, but I'm going to keep praying for that. I still have faith in prayer, even though the Lord hadn't answered it like I thought he should. I'm still praying for that. Listen again to Taylor. He said, the inference from this parable is not that we should be heard because we persevere in prayer, but rather that we should persevere in prayer even when the answer appears to be long delayed, because it is God to whom we are praying, and we know that he will always bless and will ultimately give to us what is best. Should we persevere in prayer? Certainly. That's really not the point of the parable. The point of the parable is not that we should persevere in prayer, but we should persevere in prayer when it seems like we're not being answered, when the Lord seems to be delaying. We're waiting on God. And while we wait on him, are we expressing our faith in prayer? That's the point of the parable. Now let's turn to the 11th chapter, and I call this the other parable, very similar to this, and I want to put that in junction with this one. We're going to spend very little time there, and then the lesson will be yours. I call this the other parable over in Luke chapter 11, beginning at verse 5, where a very similar parable is uttered about prayer, and we learn something there. And let's read verses 5 to 13 of Luke chapter 11. Let's see what this parable is about. And he said to them, which of you having a friend, go to him at midnight, and he say to him, friend, lend me 3 loaves, for a friend of mine has come to me on a journey, and I have nothing to set before him. And he will answer from within and say, do not trouble me. The door is now shut. My children are with me in bed, and I cannot rise to give to you. And I say to you, though he will not rise and give to him because he is his friend, but because of his persistence, he will arise and give him as many as he needs. So what I say to you, ask and it shall be given to you, seek and ye shall find, knock and it shall be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and seeks finds, and he who knocks it will be open. If a man ask for bread from any father among you, will he give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, would he give him a serpent instead of a fish? Or if he asks for an egg, would he give him a scorpion? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your heavenly Father give the Holy Spirit to those who ask him? I call this the other parable that talks about persistence. Let's talk about that. 3 or 4 things we'll mention in the lesson will be yours. Let's go back to verse 1. That parable was uttered in the context of the disciples saying, teach us to pray like John also taught his disciples. We need to learn about prayer. Teach us about prayer. And so the Lord said, okay. Look at verse 2. When you pray, say this. And so he gives them a sample prayer. We often call that the Lord's Prayer. Actually, it's the disciples' prayer. The Lord didn't pray that prayer because the Lord saying, forgive us of our sins. He had none of which to be forgiven. So this is what he taught the disciples to pray. So here's the disciples' prayer that they ought to pray. Pray like this. Then following on the heels of that, he utters this parable. This parable is a contrast and not a comparison again, just like the one before. The point in this parable is that if the request to some unmerciful and uncaring could be finally granted, so much more so with our great God. So much more so with our great God could that be granted. And so the point and the conclusion is we ought to continually pray. But I want to go to verse 8 before we leave that, and then the lesson will be yours. That his friend, he did not rise to him because he is his friend. In fact, he didn't seem to be much of a friend, did he? But because of his persistence, he will rise and give him what he needs. The word translated persistence means importunity. That helps you a lot, doesn't it? It means persistence. Now we're about back where we started. But it means literally shamelessness. It's only used one time in the New Testament, by the way. A.T. Robertson and Mar Vincent suggest, and Thayer all say it means shamelessness. Or he shamelessly asks. And it's the idea that sometimes we, filled with pride, just forget about prayer for a moment. If you had to ask somebody for help, you might be almost ashamed to ask them the first time, but you would be ashamed to go back and beg and beg and beg, and I just keep begging until finally you cave and give. But there comes a time when you're in such need that you just shamelessly ask. I'm not ashamed to ask at all, and I'm not ashamed to beg, and I'm not ashamed to ask you 10 times or 20. Whatever it takes, please, 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 please help me. And that seems to be the idea here. He shamelessly asks. I have someone come and I need bread. Would you give me? No, I can't get up. Would you give me bread? And I'm in need, and I'm in need. And he shamelessly asks. And the point is that we ought not to be filled with pride. We should shamelessly approach our God, not being ashamed to ask for whatever need it may be. And when you are shameless in asking, you will ask for whatever, and you'll ask as many times as you think you need. And the point of that is that we should continually pray. Well, that's the parable of the persistent widow, with an additional parable that makes much of the same point. And the point of the parable is that men ought always to pray and not to faint. But the context had to do with the second coming and the fact that maybe the Lord delays his answer and delays his coming, and will we still have faith in prayer even though the Lord doesn't seem to answer our prayer just like we thought he should? And he's not fulfilling his promise just like we thought he should. But he's doing it in his own time and in his own way. Do we still have faith that God will hear and answer our prayers? There may be one or more present tonight who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and while we sing?